We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Hello and welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf, here on the We Made This podcast network. My name's Mark Adams, and I am your regular host, and we are into our series of specials in between series 6 and 7, coverage of Red Dwarf. And, well, this is a first international episode where I'm going to talk to two different folk who are in Japan and Canada, but both are American, I think, unless I've just insulted them. And we're going to have a chat about the distribution of Red Dwarf internationally. So first up, I want to say hello to Vink, who hello. I'm going to call Kevin from this point on. Hello, Kevin.
That is absolutely fine. Hello. Honored to be here.
And I want to say hello to Devin Rowcliffe as well.
How you doing, Mark? Thanks for having me. And I am greatly, greatly insulted.
are you actually Canadian and not American?
Yes. I watched Red Dwarf through an American channel, so maybe that's the confusion.
That is the confusion. Is it kind of like the English-Scottish thing that I've basically done something unforgivable by calling a Scotsman an Englishman? Is it that level?
I'll never forgive you.
Shit. Oh, dear. That's a good start, isn't it?
I don't know, though. Like, if you're watching our TV signals, you're practically American there.
Well, technically, American means all of North and South America, so we'll let it go this time.
That's true.
I mean, so I can tell the difference between a British accent that's about 20 miles away. I couldn't tell you where an American was from with any accuracy at all. And when you look at the size of Britain compared to the size of America, there are states that are bigger than us. And our accents, it's like you walk 5 minutes and your accents have changed. Whereas I can't tell the difference between an American accent.
It's the same in Japan, actually. It's even more close than that. You go to just a different city and they've got their own dialect, different words, things like that, which makes it impossible to learn this language.
Actually, in Canada, in the easternmost province, Newfoundland, they put subtitles when there's a TV show from Newfoundland,
what?
Even though they're speaking English, because the Irish twang is so strong.
Wow.
Didn't they have to subtitle Trainspotting in the States as well, because no one understood the Glaswegian accent?
I think it was Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. But yeah, there was, maybe it was Trainspotting too. I don't know. Yeah,
might have been both, to be honest with
could
you.
Could have been.
Anyway, let's very quickly introduce you both properly. So, Kevin, you are Vink. Tell me about the Famicom Dojo and how you ended up in Japan, been born in Wisconsin.
Oh my goodness, that's a long story. Famicom Dojo is a podcast, podcast and YouTube channel during the early days of YouTube, when you could only make 10-minute videos and they were like postage stamp sized. But Famicom Dojo is named after a video game shop in the town that I'm living in right now, which I thought was the coolest name ever, because I imagined it would be somewhere where you train your game. And that became the slogan for the show. I wound up in Japan. Gosh, I've been living here for 17 years, but I was a student in Japan before that, kind of jumping back and forth for a while, some part-time jobs, and then I wound up here. I'm a teacher on and off, and kind of a supervisor at a company here, and I forgot what the other questions were.
I think you covered it. And okay. Devin, you are Canadian, and you actually got in touch with me and suggested this idea for an episode of the podcast. Why?
Well, I figured out pretty quickly as a listener to Shipwreck and Comatose that you had a bit of a interest, shall we say, in specials, a bit of a kink for doing as many specials as absolutely possible. So I thought,
well, there's my other kink of wanting to fuck myself, isn't there?
Yes, I heard that this series. Yeah, that was good. So yeah, I thought it might be interesting to speak about some of the rich history of Red Dwarf overseas, because particularly in the US, there's so much about PBS and whatnot that I thought that should be a part of the canon for Shipwreck and Comatose, so to speak.
And I think it's a brilliant idea. We've looked at some weird and wonderful shite, but most of the time it is just the regular five hosts. And we won't have people on willy-nilly, but this idea, I was like, fucking hell, I wish I'd had that. And then you did all the work and organized it for me as well, so thank you very much.
It's okay, I'll just send you the invoice, that's fine.
Oh yeah, a gigantic budget. It's edited by me in my living room, so yeah.
I'm just happy to be part of this kink, apparently.
So. I thought Kurt did the editing, or does he put all the specials onto you?
So he edits these ones when we're doing the episodes of the show itself. All the specials tends to be me,
right?
Because Kurt's not that into the specials. It's why you don't hear him on any of them.
Fair enough.
A busy man. He's got 25 other podcasts and then dares to suggest I've got too many podcasts. Before we get into the chat about Red Dwarf internationally, shall we do our officer's exam? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the question and I'm going to go to Kevin first, followed by Devon for the answer to each question. I did this with two other folk the other day and it got really fucking confusing. So let's just say Kevin first and then Devon. Question number one, when did you discover Red Dwarf, or what is your favorite memory of the show?
Gosh, it was junior high school, now that I think about it. So it must have been about 1994. And a friend of mine, you know, heard that I was into kind of science fiction type things, and but it wasn't phrased that way. It was like, you should watch this show called Red Dwarf. And at the time, I had no idea what it was on, because they said it was on PBS, and PBS is like the educational channel for the most part, but they also show kind of strange like foreign programs late at night, you know, like. It's where you might see Monty Python or something like that, Doctor Who, something like that. But when it was mentioned, it was never mentioned to me that it was a science fiction show. So I thought it would be like some, like, I don't know, Scandinavian stand-up comedy special or something. You know, like, it doesn't sound like, it, you know, kind of like medieval variety show or something like that. So I tuned in because she told me when it was on. And I jumped into the scene near the beginning of Dimension Jump, where they're about to ditch Rimmer and they're gonna go on a fishing trip. And again, nothing at this point has indicated to me that this is set in space, because they're just in a room and they're wearing fishing gear and they're talking about going condom fishing. And I'm like,
and the sets are shite as well. Let's be blunt.
But like, there was no indication that this was a sci-fi thing. And I was looking at it, and I'm like, this is so stupid. There was a lot of terminology that I didn't get. What was it? A 2-pound black rib nobbler or something like that? I don't remember. And I remember I turned it off. I don't think this show is for me.
Do you not get ribbed condoms in the States then?
I guess so, but there's jokes about Lister fishing in the canal and things like that, and the audience is laughing, and I'm like, I don't know why that's funny.
You've obviously never walked down a shitty canal.
Exactly, oh exactly.
God, some of the canals in Britain, holy crap. Rank.
The waterways in Wisconsin are beautiful. Anyway, but I came back and she was like, oh, did you like it? Did you like it? That was a really good one. And I'm like, I didn't really finish. And she's like, what? And convinced me to try another episode. The first episode I watched that I knew what it was and that I watched in the whole way through was Meltdown. And I think to a 14-year-old, that was a great place to start. You get to watch Gandhi blow up. You get to watch Elvis kill some people. Santa Claus is in it. Like, it was pretty great. And I just continued watching it up until the end of, like, Series 5, because that's where Red Dwarf was at that time, which, you know, they had, you know, the back to reality one. And then the show started over again, but I didn't realize it had started over again. And I'm watching the next episode. Mm. The episode's called The End. And I'm like, oh, this must be the last episode of Red Dwarf. You know, and this is before Brilliant. The internet. It was, and I started it right from the beginning. And I've been hooked ever since.
Brilliant stuff. So you said that was 1994. So in theory,
yeah,
we'd already had Series 6 by that point in the UK, but they'd obviously only sold up to Series 5 to CBS.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually watched Series 6 on bootleg tapes, which I ordered from someone who was converting the PAL tapes to NTSC so I could watch them. That's also fucking how I, that's also how I saw Smegups long before I came here.
Amazing stuff. And so let me ask about CBS. All the shows you mentioned, Monty Python, Doctor Who, Red Dwarf, they're all BBC. Was it exclusively BBC stuff, or was there some ITV, some Channel 4?
It really depends on who was the carrier, because PBS is public broadcasting system, and there's all these substations, and they all choose their own programming. So I know my station for a little while had Benny Hill, so that's not BBC. Like the later ones, like what was that, ITV or no, Thames? It was Thames, right? Or as I pronounced it at the time, Thames, because I had no idea. But that kind of weird programming came on late at night. For the most part, during the thing, it was Bob Ross like doing his painting show, and it was Sesame Street, and it was educational programs, and it was it was mostly educational programs. You watch it in school. They wheel out a TV on one of those stands, and you'd watch a program, but then at night, I don't know, it just got weird.
Fair enough.
Red Dwarf aired very, very late. Yeah,
I feel a little bit insulted that you're saying British television is weird. No, I don't. You're absolutely right. We are an odd race, and I'm kind of proud of that. So moving back to Devon, so when did you first discover Red Dwarf?
Yeah, I think it was 94 for me as well, coincidentally enough. I'm from Vancouver, which was apparently the inspiration for the Crichton accent. It was supposed to be a mix of American and Scottish. So
what's it?
For the rest of the episode, I will speak like this, because this is my natural accent.
I hope that's true, because that's fucking hilarious.
Be an interesting conversation if I ever ran into Robert Llewellyn. But I came at it actually not from the sci-fi perspective, but from the British comedy perspective. And it sounds like most of the people who talk Red Dwarf these days, big fans over the decades, mostly, not completely, but most came at it more from a sci-fi perspective than a Britcom. But I was really interested in the Britcom. So much like Kevin said, my local PBS station, which was in Seattle, we could get that in Vancouver, because in Canada, we can get a lot of the US television stations. My local PBS station would show things like Blackadder, Fawlty Towers, The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, things like that. And they would often marathon these shows. So that was my introduction to British culture, really. And I absolutely loved it. I felt that my sense of humor was a better fit for British humor than Canadian or American. So I immediately gravitated towards British comedy. I don't remember exactly how I got into it. As I said, it was around 94. There was two channels that showed Red Dwarf in Vancouver. There was YTV, which unofficially stood for Youth Television, which was a cable channel aimed at older kids and teenagers, I guess. And they would show one episode of Red Dwarf a week, usually late in the evenings, from 1990 to 1994. But where I think I really got into it was from my local PBS station, KCTS9 in Seattle. And they would, as I said, show these British comedy marathons. So they would show the entirety of Red Dwarf over a Saturday and Sunday. And they would break in every few episodes to do fundraising pledge drives.
Pledge drives, get a tote bag. Yep.
Red Dwarf t-shirts. Exactly.
Yep.
Well, so for the benefit of British folk, pledge drive?
So BBC is very well funded. It's very prominent in the UK. Yep. So Channel 1, Channel 2, those are BBC. A PBS in the United States is like a very, very, very low budget BBC, which is a much higher channel, and it has a much lower budget. So they have to seek donations from the public. So they will often have these fundraisers where they'll come in after a show and say, hey, if you love this programming, make sure to dip into your pocket and donate some money. So they would actually have Red Dwarf specific merchandise that they would give you if you donated money to this particular channel. So they'd have a Red Dwarf t-shirt, they might have some pins or VHS tapes or something like that. So
it's like a podcast with a Patreon.
Yes, I was just about to say it was Patreon before the internet. Yes.
Holy fuck. That's bizarre. There's never been anything like that on British television.
It was the stations were completely, they would say this program was brought to you by, and maybe they have a couple corporate sponsors, but then afterward it would be like, and viewers like you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so people had, they voted with their wallets too, because if not enough people were pledging to support a show, they wouldn't do it anymore. That we lost Doctor Who because it was an expensive show for them to get and it wasn't popular enough at the time. So I guess Red Dwarf was cheaper.
So my channel in Seattle would start showing Red Dwarf, I think in 92, possibly earlier, but I found evidence of 1992 they were doing a marathon.
Oh, okay.
And I was looking back, and in the mid-90s, there's an actor in the U.S. called Joel McHale. He was the lead in NBC's Community. And he does a lot of award shows where he's the host, and he's got 3.3 million Twitter followers. But way back when, in the mid-90s, when he was just starting his career, he would be one of these volunteers for the local PBS station in Seattle. So he'd say, call now, 1-800, blah, blah, blah. Get your Red Dwarf t-shirt. Support PBS. It's all educational programming. You know, Red Dwarf is only shown on stations like this, so you're going to have to dig deep, that sort of thing. And it was funny to see him go on to become absolutely massive afterwards. And what was really interesting about my specific PBS, the Seattle one, is that they actually did some original specials. So as of maybe 96, 97, when Red Dwarf really started to explode, they would actually bring in a couple of cast members from Red Dwarf to be a part of these marathons. And they would be part of the little fundraising breaks, and they would actually record original programming. So in 1997, they brought over Craig Charles and Robert Llewellyn, and they filmed a special called The Swirly Thing Alert. And in 1998, Craig Charles and Danny John Jules. Yeah, Craig Charles and Danny John Jules came out, and they did a special called Smegheads in Seattle. Those are both on YouTube, actually. So Swirly Thing Alert and Smegheads in Seattle.
Totally going to look for those,
I am absolutely going to suggest we do a special on those.
Our station brought, I mean, they didn't have the money to bring the actors in themselves, but they would get them to film little promos that would play during these specials. So I think it was one where, like, I think it was Craig Charles and Danny John Jules were like saying, like, and what do you like about Wisconsin? I think the best thing in Wisconsin is watching Red Dwarf on W something something, the name of the show. And I'm like, they clearly have, you know, it was done in a way that was sarcastic enough that you knew that they knew how ridiculous the whole thing sounded. Our station was too small to bring anyone in, but I remember those things. They try to make each pledge drive their own. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Seattle channel was pretty prominent. They were actually the channel that broke the news in 2008 that Red Dwarf would be coming back after a full decade break for Back to Earth, Series 9. Yeah, that was actually during an interview with Robert Llewellyn on that PBS channel in Seattle.
Oh, that's crazy.
And one last thing I just wanted to shoehorn in here is that when I was listening to earlier episodes of Shipwreck and Comatose, many of you were mentioning that you started watching after 1988. So you had missed series 1 and 2. And because the VHS tapes of series 1 and 2 came out later in the UK after 3 through 6, I suppose. Many of you didn't see series 1 and 2. It was almost like a prequel. But for those of us who had PBS, they would marathon the entire block starting from series 1. So it's entirely possible that a lot of Americans and Canadians saw series 1 and 2 prior to British people who got into Red Dwarf after 1988.
Yeah.
Good grief. That's fascinating. I mean, I don't know how old either of you are, but the Shipwrecked and Comatose hosts all tend to be late 30s, early 40s. So we do have a similar experience of what you just described.
Mm-hmm. Early 40s here. Yep.
Yeah, early 40s.
And I want to ask you about these channels that you were watching in Vancouver, Devon. Was it technically illegal for you to watch these as they were American channels in Canada?
No, it's much like living in Scotland or Wales or Ireland and you get a large chunk of the English channel. So we received all of the US networks and quite a few of the kind of secondary cable channels as well in Canada.
Right. And you, as long as you could tune in, it was legal to watch them.
Yeah. I didn't use a dish. I actually just bought cable, something we do here. I think in the UK, I'm not sure how it works. When I was in the UK, you got 5 channels. And I wasn't sure how to get additional channels, but here you would subscribe to cable to get any channels, essentially, like dedicated from a dedicated signal. And if you had a normal cable package, you would get the majority of US networks as well as PBS. So I think it was pretty common. If you lived in the southern part of Canada, it was pretty common to get a PBS station. So for example, in Toronto, where I live now, we get two different New York State PBSs. And I'm sure that's similar with other Canadian cities near the border. They would pick up their local American PBS station.
Fascinating. I mean, for me now, I literally watch one television program, the same television program, live every year. And it's the only one I watch live. And that is the Eurovision Song Contest.
Eurovision!
Everything else I will watch on catch up, the BBC iPlayer or Netflix or whatever. I remember like 2 years ago, I couldn't work out how to actually get live telly on my fucking telly. And I had a panic. I was like, I'm going to miss Eurovision. I'm going to miss Eurovision. I'm gay and I'm going to miss Eurovision. How is this possible? It should be illegal. So,
How would you rate Iceland's performance?
Iceland? Was Iceland?
I'm just taking the piss.
Was Iceland Daddy Freya last year? I just can't remember. I think Daddy Freya, if I'm remembering rightly, and they were bloody brilliant. But my favourite last year was Finland, because they sounded like mid-90s Linkin Park.
Sorry, listeners.
But we digress. This is not a Eurovision podcast, and I can't have another podcast. So move on to question two, and what's your favourite episode of Red Dwarf?
Gosh, you know, this was the hardest question on this questionnaire. I was thinking about it a lot because it really varies. Like, I think my answer for a long time was Gunman of the Apocalypse, just because I thought it was
correct
so,
choice,
so interesting. And then for a long time, I would think White Hole just had so many things. But I'm gonna go with a kind of strange one here. I'm gonna go way back to the beginning, and I'm gonna say Future Echoes.
Oh.
Okay, and why would you pick that one?
There was just such amazing wordplay in that one. There was just such, you know, it hasn't happened yet. It has been going to have happened, but it hasn't actually happened. Just if you, like, read it, you know, it's because they couldn't do much with special effects, and they couldn't do much with the sets, so there was just some just amazing... The giddiness of Rimmer knowing that Lister's about to die. So I blow up then. Well, bits of you do. Like, it's just, there's so many great lines in that. I'm a fan of the first series quite a bit. And when I was rewatching it, though, I found that I was laughing so hard during Future Echoes. And I just thought it was such an amazing idea. And they really flesh it out a lot in the novel as well. You get more into that whole thing, but I don't know. Can I go back to Gunman of the Apocalypse? I don't know. Like, there's a lot of good episodes of Red Dwarf.
You can definitely go back to Gunman of the Apocalypse because that is the correct answer.
Overrated.
Devin, how about you?
I'm going to stick to the same series, actually. I'm going to go with Me Squared. Ooh. And I think this might have to do with the fact that we as North Americans saw series one maybe at the very beginning rather than later, almost like a prequel, that it hit us quite hard. Some of our early memories are from series one and two. But Me Squared was hilarious to see Rimmer bunking with himself, just being an absolute prat, and then going on to having a blazing row with himself. Holly's April Fool joke about the Norweb space fighters coming to track Lister down for leaving the light on and leaving the half uneaten sausage in his kitchen.
Oh, underrated joke. Underrated joke, yeah.
And then winding up with the gazpacho soup joke and then the super.
Oh, I mean, that is possibly the best gag of the entire series, super. It's just so simple and so fucking British. And that episode is the first episode that got me talking about whether or not I would fuck future me. Just out of interest, seeing as we've brought that up. So if you had time traveling you turn up, would you have sex with him?
After you, Kevin.
Well, I mean, no one else will, so sure. It feels sad to me that, like, gazpacho soup joke will always be overshadowed now by our politicians in the United States with Marjorie Taylor Greene calling them the gazpacho Nazis, or no, sorry, the gazpacho, what was it? The gazpacho, yes, that's right. Police. That's right. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is a Red Dwarf thing, you know?
Yes, exactly.
You can't take this away from Red Dwarf, but now now Gazpacho Soup's funny for that reason, and it should be funny because... anyway.
Yeah, she meant Gestapo. She meant Gestapo, but she said Gazpacho, and that was the joke, yes. If anyone missed that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really dopey. I hadn't heard that joke, but the fucking hell.
Well, it wasn't a joke, though. She really did think that it was pronounced that way. That's the problem.
That's Republican wit.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. Let's move on. And what was your favorite season of Red Dwarf, Kevin, first again?
It's season one. And, you know, I think for that very reason, because that was the season, you know, they reran a lot or whatever, because... as this, you know, the stations would do these marathons, and those are the ones that played during the prime time hours when you'd watch it, because they'd go all night. So, you know, by the time the later seasons were on, I mean, we were always videotaping them off the TV, of course, but like I watched series one a number of times, and again, since I couldn't get a lot of Red Dwarf stuff, I remember I got the Red Dwarf novels, and you know that. Well, those are mostly concerned with events of the first three seasons. So like when you rewatch them with that context in, I think you gain even more from it. And I always thought Red Dwarf shined the best when it wasn't just being a Monster of the Week show, when it was actually about that human relationship. I've always been fans of like when sitcoms or when a stage play does a scene. And that's why in the later seasons, Marooned, I think, is such a great episode. Because it kind of draws back to that, and why there are some great scenes in series eight that kind of harken back to that, maybe not to the same effect, but yeah, season one.
And how about you, Devin?
Well, I thought my answer was going to be very unconventional because everyone on your show thus far has said series three onwards, particularly 4, 5, 6. But I agree with Kevin, and I'm going to say series one. Having Lister and Rimmer drive each other insane, to me, was classic Red Dwarf, very much like Porridge or The Odd Couple in the United States.
Yep.
Mm.
And it was just full of so many good episodes. Waiting for God, you had the Quagars. You had
the fucking chicken.
Exactly.
It's a garbage pod.
It's a smegging garbage pod. And then you had Lister as the god of the cats, another dig at the religious, as Mark likes to point out. That was quite good. Yeah. Confidence and paranoia. Little things like raining fish absolutely had me in stitches. You never see anything like that in North American comedy at the time. And as I said, Me Squared, I absolutely love that. Rimmer going from being in love with himself to absolutely detesting himself. And also having Norman Lovett as Holly. I really did like Hattie Heyridge, but Norman Lovett for me was always the Holly. And to have him in series one and two, I actually was thinking back. I didn't realize how quickly he left after series two. But there are some downsides to series one and two, I suppose, not having Crichton as a permanent cast member. And I guess the cat was a little bit one-dimensional, and I know he's your favorite character, Mark. So obviously you're not going to say series one or two. But for those of us who really like to see Lister and Rimmer driving each other mad, series one takes the cake, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I love series one and two, Cat. I love the shallowness and the actual cattiness.
Wow.
I fucking love cats. And the fact that they basically anthropomorphized an actual cat in the first two series.
Oh, yeah.
You're right, though. It is almost like the character development creates a new character from what we saw in series one or two.
Yeah.
But I love all versions of the cat. And it is painful to me when I block my cat out of my office when I'm recording this episode. It's been half an hour and I've not seen my cat.
How am I looking?
Well, exactly.
Well, how am I looking now?
I'm looking now, Chase.
She's probably doing that right now. Or telling off the pigeons through the window. Anyway, that nicely leads to the fourth question, which is who is your favorite character in the show?
Okay, favorite character in the show. I mean, it's such an ensemble cast. It's hard. When I was younger, I looked up to Lister, which sounds kind of strange because he's a total slob. but you know, he was, you know, the non-conforming, but at the same time, he had, you know, a good heart underneath layers of curry and things like that. But you know, just absolutely hilarious character. But as I got older, and when I rewatched the show recently, I'm like,
Rimmer is the character who is holding this whole thing together. You know what I mean? He's the one who creates the real conflict, especially in the early seasons before there was, you know, one of the crazy things about the first seasons is they never ran into anything, or, you know, there was almost no peril other than what they created for themselves. So he is so, I mean, Chris Barry is so funny to watch, you know, and I've recently started rewatching The British Empire as well for the same reason. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'll say it's Rimmer.
Good choice. Not the right choice, but a good choice. And how about you, Devin?
I'm afraid Devin is going to ape Kevin again, and I'm going to have to agree and say Rimmer as well. He was the perfect foil for Lister, as I've already mentioned from the kind of the Porridge and the Odd Couple references. I grew to love his neuroticism and how complicated of a character he became over the series. And we kind of peel back his life like layers of an onion and see how he became so disturbed. It was quite fun. And I really enjoy Chris Barry as an actor. I've gone back and watched a lot of Spitting Image, his impressions there, and even listened to Son of Cliché, that radio program that Grant and Naylor did prior to Red Dwarf. I really, really enjoyed Rimmer. I think I also kind of enjoyed Lister maybe initially, but once I became a little more mature, definitely fell in love with the Rimmer character. I'd say second would probably be Holly, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Not the cat.
Definitely.
Well, you used to be fishing for Holly. I think you were hoping Matt Latham would say Holly way back when. But I really did like Norman Lovett as an actor. His deadpan humor was great. I actually had the pleasure of seeing him in person in 2006, where he was doing his plastic bags act, where he would just hold up a plastic bag and let it slowly fall to the floor of the stage. And people would just be laughing because it was so surreal.
I mean, we are planning on looking at the different stand-ups by all the people who have been in Red Dwarf. But that's a new one. So far, I've got PBS specials and the plastic bag act to add to my list of specials.
Sorry, listeners.
When I was in high school, we had a science fiction club and we hosted a Red Dwarf marathon at the stage of our school. So we were able to get a projector. We had the copies that I'd taped off TV. I realize now what a terrible idea this was. But we decided to film little interlude specials in between where we cosplayed as the characters. I was Holly. I got a bald cap. I found some black sheets to put behind me. And I hope the tape never surfaces because it must be a tremendously insulting British accent as well. So.
I hope it does surface, and if it does, please send it my way, and I'll stick it on our social media.
Or I have a new special about that.
We could.
We advertised it like crazy, and I believe we got 7 people who came to this event, and there were like 15 of us hosting it. So it was fun.
Okay, and the fifth question is, what is your favorite moment in the entire show's run? Again, we'll go with Kevin first.
I'm gonna just sum it up with just 7 words. Or we could just use the teleporter. It was so refreshing because that always bothered me in science fiction shows where they have this amazing technology but they have to use all these convoluted ways of getting out of things. But Lister proposes, I believe, is that from Meltdown?
Yes, it is.
Okay, we can take out a few of these guards, we'll steal their swords, we'll fight our way out of here. And Crichton is like, or we could use the teleporter. And I just thought that was the funniest thing. Moments like that when the show is, you know, realizes what it is, but is still kind of in universe with the whole thing, that made me totally fall in love with the show. And again, that was one of the first episodes I watched in full, so I think that had a big effect.
I think there's a real deadpan quality to a lot of the Red Dwarf gags, but at the same time, it also heavily takes the piss out of Star Trek with stuff that, doesn't it? And
one time directly, too. Is this the human emotion that you call friendship? It's too early in the morning for the Star Trek crap. Yeah, it's very...
Mm.
Yeah.
And so how about you, Devin?
From the episode The End, I'll have to say Rimmer writing the officer's exam, or the first technician's exam, or whatever the exam was, where he writes, "I am a fish 400 times, there's a funny little dance and feints." And what really sold that scene for me was Todd Hunter's reaction, the Robert Bathurst who's gone on to become a famous actor. He kind of looks at Rimmer falling over, he kind of just shakes his head and looks away like he never saw it. And then they're wheeling Rimmer away in a wheelbarrow or some kind of medical device. And he says, "I think I did quite well."
Oh, man. That's a great scene.
That's not conventionally a major Red Dwarf moment, but little things like that just really, really got me. Defining the characters, I guess.
And the final question, and it is probably the most important one.
Okay.
Would you like some toast?
It's another bready question, isn't it?
That always works well with people who haven't heard an episode of the show, whereas if they have heard it, they're like, well, we know that gag's coming, and it's not quite as good.
So what's your answer, Kevin?
No, I would not. I would not like any toast. Oh, fine, I'll have some.
Good, I'm glad. Since we last recorded an episode where we did these questions, I have actually bought a bread maker. So that is borderline a legitimate question now, because I do make my own bread. So, you know.
There you go.
My boyfriend bought a soup maker and I got jealous. So I bought a bread maker. I am a ridiculous human being. Right, let's move
on. Hang on. I haven't answered this question yet.
Oh, that's true. Go on then.
Mark, I want no toast, no muffins, no tea cakes, no buns, baps, baguettes, or bagels, no croissants, no crumpets, no pancakes, no potato cakes, and no hot crust buns. And definitely no smegging flapjacks.
You've written that down. There's no way you've done that from memory.
So you're a waffle man.
How very Rimmer-like of me to cheat.
I also cheated. Hold on. Right. I am a fish.
Right, let's move on and talk about the actual stuff that happened in your respective countries. Do you feel that the British humour that is clearly one of the most important elements of Red Dwarf, do you feel like that actually works in the show's favour, or does it cause a bit of a kind of almost like a language barrier for viewers in your countries? And I mean, you can talk about the States, but also talking about Japan and Canada as well.
In the States, I mean, there's definitely some references we don't get, especially when they bring in brands and things. It took me a long time. I didn't know what a topic bar was, for example, and that's used in jokes, right. You know, things like that. And I mean, I was lucky that I was on the internet, you know, pre-web, you know, you going on Rec Arts, Red Dwarf, like the Usenet group. And I read all these FAQ things to find out information about some of the jokes that I wasn't getting. But for the most part, not a big deal. But British comedy does not translate very well into Japanese unless it's absolutely absurd or really physical. For example, Mr. Bean is super popular here, like crazy popular, probably the biggest British comedy hit. And Blackadder is unknown, completely unknown. It's interesting. They're both Rowan Atkinson, but like the physical humor of Mr. Bean translates in incredibly well. There's no translation necessary, but Blackadder is political. Blackadder is sarcastic, and sarcasm in general doesn't translate super well into Japanese. So like they enjoyed Monty Python here, and probably because it's very visual, it's very physical, it's very absurd, you know, and you know, you can translate it and you don't really have to understand it without knowing that it's funny for that. But like, I feel that they might think it's funnier in different ways. Like sometimes I think maybe the sarcasm layer is lost a little bit. Has anyone watched the Japanese dub of Red Dwarf? It's a special feature on the first DVD set, the season one set.
No, I haven't. I didn't know it was there. I'll be honest. Up until recently, I was watching Red Dwarf on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
To do the episodes of the show.
Yeah.
And it was only when they removed it from Netflix because they launched BritBox that I bought the Blu-ray. And there's so much fucking stuff that we could do special forever.
There's so many extras and they're so interesting. They are, but one of the special features on at least the US version of the DVD set for series one was they had the episode The End in Japanese with the Japanese dub. And when I was watching it the first, you know, when I watched it before I moved here, I thought it was just funny how what voices were chosen and things like that. But now that I've been here, you can some of the jokes are definitely changed somewhat in order so that they would be funny on their own without having to be necessarily sarcastic or things like that. It's different, but I think since Red Dwarf is that kind of situation comedy with sci-fi elements, I think it translates a lot better than something like, say, Yes, Prime Minister or something like that. You know, something that really requires a lot of background or a lot of wordplay. I mean, Red Dwarf definitely has wordplay, but at the same time, it's not necessarily... You know, its own history has changed so many times over the years, it's not necessary that you follow it exactly.
Well, yes.
Red Dwarf is not, it never became a big hit here. I've never actually seen it on Japanese television because you need a satellite dish to do that. But I have seen the DVDs in shops before. And when I first came to Japan, I think I sent a picture to the group. I think I found an old picture of myself my first day in Japan back in 2001, and I'm sitting by the train station looking confused, wearing my Red Dwarf shirt. That same day, someone came up to me and went, "Ah, Red Dwarf, ah, you know," and they were like really happy that someone else knew of the show.
Amazing.
They asked me if I was British, and I wasn't, and they looked a bit disappointed. But, you know, because they probably were like, oh, you know, the novels came, at least the first two novels came out here with the Japanese translation, and there's a fan base here for the show. They got it a little later than the other countries, so the Japanese versions of the first few series are the remastered versions. There's no Japanese dub There's no Japanese dub of the originals, as far as I've been able to find. They got it later, so yeah.
Do you mean the terrible CGI shite?
Yes.
Oh no.
Yeah. So the fact that they're still into it even after that is a real testament to this country.
And how about you, Devon? Do you feel like there is a significant difference in British humor to Canadian?
I'd say that Canadian humor is probably a bit closer to British humor than American, and it was a reasonably good fit. When I was young, especially in Canada, there were quite a few older people with a British accent walking around Canada. So there seems to be a lot of British ooze in this country still. I would say things like sarcasm and very dry, dark wit do fit pretty well in Canada. But I think it was a lot of the individual references that went over my head when I was listening. Like Holly, he would say Gordon Bennett, something like that. Or there's references to Peter Beardsley, the footballer, and, you know, brand names like Tippex that we don't have here, or, you know, jokes about Wales, like less choice than a fish and chip shop in Wales, things like that. Those kind of went over my head. But overall, I think
Kevin Keegan as well, right?
That's right, yes. But yeah, overall, the humor went well. I think the fact that it was simply sci-fi might have reduced its interest, maybe both in Canada and the US. But from a comedy perspective, I think it did pretty well in Canada. But yeah, it was relatively a niche or a cult show, just like Kevin said, in the US.
Yeah.
We've touched on this, when you were talking about your first experiences with Red Dwarf. So you accessed it through this PBS,
yeah.
Public Broadcast something.
Yeah.
How do you access it now?
Oof. I mean, for me, I have pretty much every season on DVD, except the newest, the Dave stuff I bought through iTunes. But I prefer to get, I don't know, I'll eventually probably get the Blu-rays because I love special editions and like I like watching the commentaries and things like that. But I wanted to pick up the Japanese DVDs, but they're actually intensely expensive. One season of Red Dwarf goes for about Nimanen, which is, 20,000 yen, which would be about 110, 115 pounds. I don't know what the exchange rate is right now.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's really, really expensive. DVDs in Japan are really expensive to begin with. But the thing is, they still have rental shops here. They still have that economy going on where you could rent things. But a lot of the, especially like things that are a little more obscure, a little more cult, you know, I think, yeah. So I had just avoided buying the Japanese discs altogether. Because I've tried a couple times to get my wife is Japanese, and I've tried to get her to watch Red Dwarf, and she just has absolutely no interest whatsoever in English, in Japanese, in anything, you know. So it's unfortunate.
That's fascinating that the culture is so different. I paid £45 for series 1 to 8 on Blu-ray, and you're saying it's 100 and some quid for one series. Fuck.
Yeah. This was a few years ago. I haven't priced them recently. Now they might be doing some box sets there together, but yeah, it was just ridiculously expensive. And because I mean, for a while they were releasing them, I think like 1 or 2 episodes a disc, and like with its own packaging. We also think like take, you know, even what they've invented, anime, you know, the Japanese animation is several times more expensive in Japan than it is in other countries, which you'd think wouldn't be. But like if you want the Neon Genesis Evangelion box set, you can pick it up for about $40 in the US, and it costs about maybe 150 here.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. And I think this is the kind of stuff that I wanted to kind of tease out with this conversation that we're having. And the huge difference in access and the amount it would cost. Do you not have any kind of streaming services in Japan?
Pretty recently, we got Netflix about 8 years ago, but there's very little British stuff on there. No, I don't think I could access BritBox here. I was trying to stream because I didn't have the Dave season, so I was really hoping I could find somewhere to stream it, but I eventually had to wind up buying episodes. But even the iTunes service in Japan doesn't have television episodes on it, only movies. But I still have a U.S. account and a credit card linked to the U.S., so I used my U.S. account to buy the episodes. Otherwise, I think for just a Japanese consumer, I think really the only way to watch it right now is live if you have satellite television or through intensely expensive DVDs.
Good grief. And so what's the experience in Canada like then, Devon?
I think that PBS station that I saw Red Dwarf on back in the 90s, I don't think it's really showing it anymore. I think they had one last marathon in 2014, but I think over the past 10-15 years it's kind of dropped off. But I would say the main way people would watch it in Canada would be through streaming it on BritBox. You can also purchase it on Apple TV and stream it, but that's a bit different than just, you know, having a subscription to BritBox. You'd actually have to buy it and then stream it from Apple. In the US it's the same thing. You can buy it you can stream it through BritBox, but they also have Apple and Amazon, and I think there's a few other minor streaming services that have it. I've been a cheeky bugger and sometimes used VPN and watched Dave or UK TV, things like that when it first came out. But I have most of the series on DVD and I'll probably end up buying the majority of them. But it's unfortunate because if you didn't know Red Dwarf and you were flipping channels and you came across it in the 90s, you'd be interested. It would catch your interest.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd say, what is this? But now that everything's streaming, I don't know if people would stumble upon it the same way they would before. Maybe not, I guess.
So fascinating that you've both talked about the two different companies that produce Red Dwarf, the BBC and Dave.
Yeah.
The stuff on BBC box set 1 to 8, which I've said was £45. Yeah. Each individual series of the Dave stuff is somewhere between £8 or £12. Mm. And I deeply resent paying £10 for the fucking awful Back to Earth. And
I was gonna say it's not that bad, but yeah,
it is that bad.
Do you know, we're not that far away from covering it, and I'm like, oh, can someone else do it?
It's only 3 episodes.
I had to import it here and pay the shipping to go here, so I couldn't just watch it. So I think in the end I paid what would be equivalent of what for you would be about £40 to watch that.
Bloody Nora.
Yeah.
That is not £40 well spent.
Oh my goodness, no. I mean, I It was the idea that something good could happen, but yeah, it was, yeah, it, yeah.
I mean, something good did happen. Because apparently, I've never watched any of it, and I've been forced to not watch any of it as part of the gimmick of this podcast, but apparently the Dave series have got a lot of good episodes in them.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in there. Definitely not Back to Earth, but in subsequent series, there are some interesting episodes, definitely.
There are definitely some moments that bring back, but I will find myself going back to the initial six series again mm-hmm. and again and again, and then I'll dip my toes into seven and eight as well. Then there's some fun moments in those too, but I don't think I can watch the Dave stuff in any frequently, you know.
Mm. So touching on what we've been talking about, how the BBC and the Dave stuff. So we've discussed in the past on various episodes how we kind of see there being almost phases of Red Dwarf.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas one and two is one phase,
yep.
three to six, seven and eight, and then the Dave stuff. Or you could couple all the BBC stuff together, etc. Or series one to six together and just the seven and eight. But do you feel that there are phases in your countries, or is it almost not seen in a similar vein to where the British folk might look at it?
There's definitely a jump between series two and series three. And, but like, I think it, again, because of how we often have watched it, which would be kind of marathon style, just going from episode to episode, it's maybe a little less apparent. I don't know how it is for everyone, but for me, there will always feel to be a gap and almost a seasonal shift between series five and series six.
Now, that's fascinating. I've never heard that before. Why would you say that is perceived like that?
Because the way that PBS was working, there was a huge gap between when they got, when series five ended and when they got series six. And the episode Back to Reality almost seemed like a series finale in a lot of ways. So it was almost like a conclusion. And then we had to wait a long time. And a lot of PBS stations also dropped the program after series five because there was a gap in getting new stuff. And then, of course, there was, you know, some controversy with Craig Charles around that time, right after series.
Yeah.
Was it right? Yeah. Right after series six. So, you know, there was a lot of thought between with some of these stations of maybe we don't want to invest in this program anymore because it looks like it's kind of done. So, again, I had to watch series six from bootleg tapes. And for me, maybe because it was hyped up so much, maybe because of the long delay, it looked like a different type of product. After series five, you lose Holly. You're just in Starbug. There's a lot of jokes that are kind of become like catchphrases that extend through the six episodes, which are kind of tightly together. Series six to me will always feel like its own thing.
Fascinating. So it seems to me like the gap between six and seven that British folk experienced.
Yeah.
You experienced between five and six.
That's right. That's right. And of course, between six and seven, but it was almost as pronounced the first time, yeah.
And how about you, Devin?
I was actually thinking about this. I was trying to figure out when series six was first shown over here, because as Kevin said, I started watching in 94. Series six came out in the UK in 93. I had this distinct memory where I was recording all the episodes during a marathon. And I think I actually went out that day and I came back later and eventually watched all of them. And I realized I only have series one to five here. And I was pretty sure they were showing series six in 94, but I wasn't sure if it was a VCR error or what it was. And I remember for the longest time being so annoyed with myself because I only had series one through five. And the subsequent marathon, they did show series six. I don't know what year that was. Perhaps the Seattle channel got series six earlier. I don't know. But I had this distinct memory being so cross with myself that I screwed up the VCR recordings of series six. So I would say there's a bit of a gap between five and six for me as well, just because of when I watched it. I think it was Matt Latham who was talking about a gap between one and two and then three and six because of the production quality and possibly some people watching one and two in the UK later. But for me, although there is a very stark difference, you know, there's different Holly and there's you have Crichton and Cat is different. I would say for the most part, 1 to 6 or at least 1 to 5 do kind of blend together for me. But I can see Matt's point and having 1 and 2 as a kind of a separate era. That was 3 through 6 or 3 through 5 for us North Americans, I guess.
We talked about the books very briefly before as well. And I was surprised that you got them because, again, I've struggled to get some American imported books myself when I've been into stuff that wasn't easily accessible. So you got the British books. Weren't they published by Penguin, if I remember rightly, a British publisher?
In the UK, they were. Here, they were published by, was it Tor? I don't remember. Or Dell something. I don't remember. But they actually got American prints. They did. My library had the first one.
Good grief.
And there was a weird misprint on the Better Than Life US edition where they made the wrong letters red in the Red Dwarf logo. So it looks like, if you read just the white letters, it looks like Ed By. I'm sorry, I'll have to look at the picture. But I remember I was looking at it and I'm like, that's wrong. But only the first two. And I think to this day, we never got the second two novels in the United States. I imported them.
Right.
Which was in a pre-Amazon time, actually. Huh.
Yeah.
So you maybe got it on eBay or something.
I had a few of them as well. I don't recall how or when, and I think I read them once and didn't touch them again, but I had a few of them. So it's possible that more were available in Canada than the United States. And I have a distinct memory of reading Robert Llewellyn's autobiography, The Man in the Rubber Mask, while I was on an airplane one time. I don't recall if I bought it in an airport or what was going on there, but I was newly in love with Red Dwarf, and suddenly I got a hold of an autobiography, and I was absolutely in love with reading it, and I guess that's how it led me into the actual Red Dwarf books from that.
I remember when we looked at the Smegazines, we discovered just how much a tape of the audiobook versions cost. I think it was like something like £25 in the 1990s, and now you can get it for £7 on Audible. And £25 in the 1990s is like 45, 50 quid now. And it seems so bizarre how hard it was to access stuff like this.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems like it was even worse for you over in the States.
Oh, I paid so much to get the Red Dwarf stuff. As I said, I was buying bootlegs for more than probably new tapes were, because Series 6 was the forbidden fruit at the time, because I was reading about Red Dwarf on the internet, and people were all quoting, you know, and I knew that, and I'd heard that Dwayne Dibley was back, and you know, like there was all, and Ace Rimmer was back, and like there was all this, and I really wanted to see it. And what's weird was I actually acquired the second half of, which would be called Red Dwarf 6 Bite 2, before I saw the first half. Because that was just all that was available. So I saw episodes 4, 5, and 6 before 1, 2, and 3, which was a little weird. And what did I pay for my Smegups tape? After shipping, I would say I paid about $45. So maybe back then, £30.
That's quite a lot back then, at least, yeah.
And it was someone's copy of a tape as well. So like it wasn't even a very high quality videotape. So getting Red Dwarf stuff was really hard. And I imported some Smegazines too, actually. I had just a few issues. And what else did I have? I had the Red Dwarf American Pilots. I had I had Danny John Jules' video that he did for Tongue Tied, which had like the several different versions of it, and Elvis and two Hollies, and it was really weird.
And every single version was awful apart from the main one.
Oh yeah. But I really I liked the song, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna pick. I got Craig Charles' stand-up special Live on Earth, which was the dirtiest stand-up I'd seen at that point in my life. Just tremendously dirty.
British stand-up is pretty vulgar. at least it can be.
Oh yeah, I mean, so is U.S. stand-up, but at the time I hadn't been exposed to a lot of stand-up. This is before Netflix and things like that, you know. So I got this, and I'm like, it's going to be Lister. And it's, oh, okay, it was good. I learned a lot from that. So
yeah, some of his beat poetry is pretty risque, shall we say, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, in addition to the books, I had one copy of this magazine. I don't remember if it was purchased domestically or if I ordered it from overseas, but it was the, I think it was volume 2, number 5. It's a blue color with Dwayne Dibley on it. Dwayne Dibley is the man from Uncool. I had that one.
Yes.
It might have been on the stands here because we did have some magazine shops that brought in foreign magazines, so I probably did buy it here.
I got it at a sci-fi convention. Got it at a sci-fi convention. I paid a lot for it.
Yeah,
and I'm sure, as you both know, you can just download them for free now. And we've put that link on the website. The company that distributed it doesn't exist anymore, so you're hardly stealing from anyone, really.
Yeah, I wanna see it because I enjoyed the comic versions of it. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Some of the comic strips are absolutely sublime. Some of them are weird and some of them are terrible, but some of them are exceptionally good. Like, I've been blown away reading this magazines for this podcast because I didn't read them at the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting venue for them to explore non-canon storylines, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Mm. And something else that you mentioned very briefly when we were talking, doing the officer's exam, was the anti-religious stuff. And obviously, the States, well, frankly, is a lot more religious and sensitive about religion than the UK. How did gags like that go down? Were they more controversial there, do you think?
I think the obscurity of Red Dwarf kept it from being controversial. Like, the people who were seeking out Red Dwarf, and PBS viewers in general, have this stereotype of being kind of lefty, you know. Okay. Basically, you know the episode Polymorph when Rimmer has his snidiness sucked out and he becomes that goateed man?
Yes.
You know, that is the image of a PBS viewer. That is like what we assume a PBS viewer looks like. Like someone who has the tote bag, who has been pledging to these shows. So I think that you're not going to get a lot of, you know, as much pushback. But I grew up in a fairly religious household, and I think if I was watching it with my parents around, they might, I mean, they didn't let me watch Monty Python and the Life of Brian. I had to sneak over to a friend's house to watch that one because they were pretty sure I'd go to hell if I saw that. And I'm really hoping they're wrong. well, I guess we'll see. But to tell you the truth, the ideas in some of those episodes did maybe lead me to thinking about other options of how people think. As I said, I grew up fairly religious. I just that episode of Back to Reality, where they say the irony is that Lister, the ultimate atheist, turned out in fact to be God. But the idea of, was it Camille when they were talking about the electronic Bible for the first time, or was that
in Silicon Heaven,
that might have been The Last Day, actually, but it was explored in a few of them, and it goes into it in a lot more detail about the book. I think that's the first time I went, he believes this because it was, but like, is that the same reason I believe these things? You know, it was kind of, it was a bit eye-opening there. I mean, I still consider myself a somewhat religious person. I'm more of a frying pantheist now, so.
Nice. But you genuinely feel that it was Red Dwarf that made you at least question your faith?
Maybe not that exclusively, but it was one of the things early in my life that made me not so much question it, of just the idea of, you're absolutely right. Most American shows wouldn't have gone into anything that would be considered possible blasphemy, you know, just for commercial purposes. But I wouldn't say it was Red Dwarf alone, but those ideas definitely kind of sprouted from that time in my life.
Amazing. And do you have anything that you want to talk about with regards to the kind of anti-religious stuff in Red Dwarf and how that was affected in Canada, Devin?
I think we're a bit more open to stuff like that here. I don't think it was too big of a deal. I'm sure some older people might have thought it was blasphemous, but I think it was kind of a refreshing take on the world.
Was it really necessarily anti-religious, though? You know what I mean?
No, it was done very subtly. It wasn't just saying, yeah, you know, screw this religion, screw that religion. A lot of it was very clever and very subtle. So it was well
it
done
was
in that way.
It was definitely mocking, in my opinion. Yeah. And I think someone like myself who has zero religion,
yeah,
is perhaps more sensitive to it than someone who does have faith. Mm. Because it's so clear that people that I sometimes associate with are anti-religious and unpleasant about it. Mm. Whereas I'm never sure that Red Dwarf went as far as unpleasant, but there was some quite savage mockery. I feel like the stuff in this first series with the priest was pretty damning.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was any active cruelty there, but definitely mockery.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, the whole idea of organized religion. I mean, the Dave stuff goes farther, you know, so.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah, there's an episode you'll watch called Lemons. I don't think you want you don't want spoilers, right?
Keep them light if you're going to do spoilers.
They go back in time and meet a fairly important person.
It's going to be Jesus, isn't it?
I mean, the episode is called Lemons, so you can figure. it would spoil it if I revealed whether it was or wasn't. So yeah.
Okay, but so you think the Dave stuff goes even further than the BBC stuff? That is fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. And
is that more or less controversial in a more modern context than it was when you were originally getting Red Dwarf, the BBC stuff?
You know, it would be interesting to see because, again, like the Dave stuff is actually even harder to get here because unless you're like actively subscribed to BritBox or are willing to buy the overpriced DVDs or Blu-rays, I think very few people are being exposed to Red Dwarf that weren't already exposed to Red Dwarf. I think it's it's very hard to make a new Red Dwarf fan these days. It really is. I've tried to show it to a lot of my younger coworkers to try to get them involved, but like the early episodes are harder, you know, with the budget and everything. You've got to. Plus, I think I oversell it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm so excited about it that I think, you know, when they see it, they're like, yes, he cleans a chicken soup machine. It's everything's gray. Mm. You know, so you know, I think it's hard to expose a new person to it because these days we have a million billion choices of everything. There's a million YouTube channels. There's 1,000 stations. There's tons of streaming services. But back when in the 90s, when I was watching Red Dwarf, there was nothing else like it. It was really, really, for me, revolutionary.
I would just say that from my observations, U.S. society and U.S. comedy in particular has evolved quite a bit, and you would be able to get away with a lot more risque content today than you would 30 years ago. So,
There's a contingent in the United States right now who would have hated it back then and hate it more now, but that's not worth talking about.
Yeah. Right. So I am going to end with. I'm trying not to make this a loaded question, but we are all aware of a certain remake that was wretched. Would you like your country, be it the States, Japan, or Canada, any of those three, would you like your country to remake Red Dwarf?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say that there were some good lines in the American pilot.
Were there? I must have missed that.
All right. Okay. Robert Llewellyn saying, you've been alone for 3 million years. What have you been doing? I've been reading that fire exit sign. That is a wonderful line, and it would have fallen into, you know, it's sad that there were just a few really nice moments, mostly involving Crichton, to tell you the honest truth. But anyway, no, my first reaction to your question was absolutely no. I would not like to see Red Dwarf remade. But then I remembered that I live in Japan. And I also remembered how nice some of the Smegazine comics were. And I want to see Red Dwarf as an anime. I want to see the Japanimation version of Red Dwarf. I want to see big spiky hair Lister, you know what I mean, powering up. I want to see there'd be lots of, you know, already Red Dwarf has that the ship has that cobbled together design of like some of the more organic designs from like Studio Ghibli and things like that. Like, once I started thinking about that, I'm like, oh, I'd definitely be on board if, you know, it got a loving remaster. And frankly, I don't think Red Dwarf could be remade in any worse way than the Back to Earth special.
I hadn't thought about anime. I was just thinking like live action, but anime or an animated series of Red Dwarf would be fucking brilliant.
It would be so good. You could do all the things that they couldn't afford to do in the show. You know, it just...
Amazing. What about you, Devin? What do you think?
I just wanted to add to that there is actually a Japanese TV show that's kind of influenced by Red Dwarf. Here's your next special idea, Mark. There's a show where there's about maybe 5 or 6 people who are in outer space, and one is a businessman in a suit, and one is a young schoolgirl, and there's about 5 or 6 different cast members or characters. And it's supposedly heavily influenced by Red Dwarf, and it's on Netflix. I don't recall the name off the top of my head, but I've got it away in my files. But yeah, it might be interesting to have a quick look at that. That might be worth doing a special on there, Mark. But in terms of your question, would I want to see a Canadian Red Dwarf? No, I would not. So the American one wasn't very good, and most Canadian, maybe it's blasphemous for me to say this, or unpatriotic anyway, but most Canadian television is very low quality, low production values. So
what do you mean? The Red Green show.
Imagine the US pilot, but with 1/10 of the budget.
Wow.
So I'll pass.
The Canadian export that was really, really popular on our PBS station was the Red Green show. If you're familiar with that, the comedy stylings of Rick Green, and they would show it right after Red Dwarf. So it was Red Dwarf followed by Red Green, and it was the Red Hour. It was just such a, and I remember being so disappointed the first time it came out, because I thought Red Green was going to be like a spinoff of Red Dwarf, and you are not, Mark, I'm sure you've never heard of this show, but it's like, oh gosh, Devin, how would you even describe it?
I didn't watch it much, to be honest. You go ahead.
It's a no budget show that was like a bunch of like, what are they? Are they're lodge members? They're members of like a hunting fishing cabin by the lake. I don't know. And they talk about fixing things and duct tape, and it's kind of indescribable, to tell you the truth. It went on for like 200 episodes.
Yeah, I would say comedies like Kids in the Hall probably did a lot better in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry to go off track now, but they'll always be associated in my mind because they were always back to back.
Amazing. So, gents, it has been a fascinating conversation where I would never have come up with this idea as a concept until Devin just randomly sent me a private message on Twitter. So thank you for that, Devin. And I'm really glad we did this.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was fun. I just thought those of us overseas had a very different experience, so it would be interesting to capture that.
So where can we find you both on the internet? How about you go first, Kevin, and tell us about your presence on that there interwebs.
All right. Well, I mean, it's not as much as it used to be, but we still have a YouTube channel called Famicom Dojo, where we talk about, like, I guess for me, they're domestic games, but for everyone else, they would be import, especially retro video games and things like that. And we started a new pod, but one of the big problems with it is, as you know from podcasting, is constantly going off on tangents. And one of the tangents we're always going off on is about television shows that we remember. And Red Dwarf used to come up a lot. So we decided to do a spinoff podcast with an intensely juvenile name called Two Boobs Watch the Tube, based on the fact that the TV is nicknamed the Boob Tube. And it's of course, two guys. We did an episode on, probably our most popular episode actually was the one we did on Red Dwarf. Things are irregular, how they come out, because different time zones and work and things like that, but both are still going. So if you go to famicomdojo.tv, there's links to all the stuff I do.
Amazing. And Devin, yourself?
I just have a book out recently in the UK called Who Ate All the Squid? Football Adventures in South Korea. And that's about me following a South Korean football club home and away for an entire season back in 2003 and all the misadventures that I got up to. It was actually the first year that a British football manager was managing a South Korean or K-League club. So it's kind of an interesting history capsule, I guess you could say. And that's out on Pitch Publishing in the UK. If you're outside the UK, you can just go to my website. It's devinrocliffe.work/book. And you can find links for every country where you can buy it and even get free international shipping. I'm on Twitter if you're interested in fan ownership of football clubs, Who Ate the Squid, or if you're interested in politics, both Canadian and British, as well as a bit of Scottish and Welsh, I'm on there as Devin Rocliffe.
And very briefly, if you're looking for me, it's at Mark Adams HC on Twitter and Instagram. I'm not going to go through all my other podcasts because I do that every fucking time. And it doesn't improve the listening figures of all the other ones. So I'm not going to bother. So I just want to say thank you to both of you again. Thank you for your time. Thank you for meeting me online at random weird ass times in your time zones. You've been brilliant. I really appreciate you both.
Yeah, thank you. It was interesting to book a special with three different time zones, three different continents, but I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, just as a passing thing, you mentioned how it was interesting to you to hear how people had such a different experience with Red Dwarf, but actually what surprises me the most is how much a lot of us had the same experience with Red Dwarf. I always figured since I was watching it as an outsider, I would have a different experience, but you know, I think there's something universal about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. And what a wonderful way to end the episode. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Shipwrecked and Comatose. Until next time.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at We Made This Pod.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
By 1989, I'd actually landed a job working at a fashion PR agency called Lynn Frank's PR. This particular issue is memorable to me because it was our first Smash Hits cover for our client, Nana Cherry. They never told you if you'd get a cover or not. There'd always be this kind of cat and mouse. Well, you know, we'll look at it as a great feature and we'll have to have our own shoot and we'll have to do this, da, 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 da. And then there's quite a long period of negotiation and you never really knew if you got the cover until it came out. And I remember, you know, when you go down and see it on this newsstand, it was a fantastic feeling. Just felt like, you know, this is my sort of goal in extra time to win the FA Cup.
Chucky Vision, a Chucky podcast.
The introduction, the editorial, if you will, was written by David Campetti, and it shows real love and isn't shy about having a dig at cheap-ass, lazy film adaptations.
Yeah, Campetti is an interesting one as the co-founder of Innovation and also the editor. Yeah, a lot of his editorials are hawking other merch, hawking, you know, the different books and stuff they're putting out. But it never felt too corporate. He has a passion in his voice that he very much is enthusiastic and enjoys that they're getting to adapt these franchises.
It does seem like he's definitely acquired Chucky because he's a fan.
Red and Berry podcast.
The theme this month was an Anne Rule book so true crime, but not The Stranger Beside Me, which is her big book that broke her, you know, broke the world of true crime fiction, not fiction, non-fiction. True crime fiction, I just said, that's not a sentence.
Yeah.
He fell in love.
Oh.
He's so in love, but still not in love enough to stop using sex workers.
Yeah. But
in love enough to not murder them. So.
Okay.
He's a romantic, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, what a man.
What a dreamy man.
But his actual name was Robert Knickerbocker.
Wow.
Which is like the best surname ever.
Do you think maybe she thought no one's going to believe this is a real name?
Well, yeah, that could have been it.
If I'm wrong, please don't correct me. I don't want to know. I want to say I'm right. Thank you.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.